Hello there. Today is Tuesday, August 20th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, two U.S. congresswomen banned from entering Israel have spoken out. Russia's president makes a rare visit to France for a meeting with President Macron.
Vladimir Putin got the stage he wanted. He's welcomed back into the Western world. He was actually asked, does he want to rejoin the G7? Russia was thrown out in 2014.
Also ahead, an underground music superstar finally gets a number one single on the Billboard 100. It's all on today's International Edition. Democratic Representatives Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib held a news conference Monday sharply criticizing Israel on Monday for denying them entry to the Jewish state and called on fellow members of Congress to visit while they cannot. Omar suggested President Donald Trump and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu were suppressing the lawmakers' ability to carry out their oversight role. At Trump's urging, Israel denied entry to the two first Muslim women elected to Congress. Tlaib and Omar, who had planned to visit Jerusalem and the Israeli-occupied West Bank on a tour organized by a Palestinian group, are outspoken critics of Israel's treatment of the Palestinians. AP correspondent Tim McGuire reports.
Congresswomen Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar questioned why they were kept out of Israel. Tlaib, a Michigan Democrat, says other members of Congress were allowed in, but they were not.
Earlier this month, in fact, 71 other members of Congress traveled to Israel, seemingly without incident.
Omar, who is from Minnesota, says Congress needs to consider cutting aid to Israel.
Stop the expansion of settlements on Palestinian land and ensure full rights for Palestinians if we are to give them aid.
Israel says the two were denied entry because of their support for an international boycott of the country that is considered a security threat. I'm Tim McGuire.
Well, here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. The U.S. tests its first ground missile, previously banned in the dissolved arms treaty with Russia. New York police have fired the officer involved in a 2014 chokehold death of an African-American man. Civil society workers run afoul of Tanzania security officials in a sign of increasing clampdowns. And G7 leaders are preparing for a summit amid fears over the global economy. Find expanded coverage of all these stories and lots more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. French President Emmanuel Macron and Russia's Vladimir Putin Monday agreed changes in Ukraine had bolstered chances of peace in its east, but clashed with Syria on Syria as the Russian leader made a rare bilateral visit to this key EU power. Macron, who hosted Russia's Putin at his summer residence in southern France, made clear he wanted to keep contacts with Moscow alive on a range of issues, even at a time of spiraling tensions with the West. The relationship between a youthful French leader who regards himself as a champion of European liberalism and the Russian strongman in power for two decades has been marked by wariness and tensions since Macron came into power in 2017. Joining us for an update on this meeting is Paris-based journalist Catherine Field. Catherine, what can you tell us about this rare visit?
Vladimir Putin arrived at the presidential island, which is on the Mediterranean, in the late afternoon. He arrived with great fanfare, arrived by helicopter, and immediately went with French President Emmanuel Macron to a press conference. This was before the talks. The press conference went on for 50 minutes, which is much longer than was scheduled. It was very interesting to watch the press conference, even though there were only two questions asked. And it was very interesting body language in lots of ways. Emmanuel Macron, the French president, was very spirited. He continually defended having invited Vladimir Putin, saying that it was very important that these channels of communication are open. I mean, he really does believe that, yes, there are differences between European Union and Russia, but these channels of communication have to be kept open. For his part, Vladimir Putin looked a little bit grumpy, looked as though he was ready for anything that was going to come at him. But again, the main point for Vladimir Putin was that he was there. He was there talking to another Western leader and making it known that Russia's input on so many issues, Syria, Iran, Ukraine, even ratifying the Paris Climate Accord, that Russia's input is essential, and for all of the major issues facing the world at the moment, that they have to talk to Vladimir Putin.
You said Putin's body language was ready for being on the defensive. Did he need to at all, or was it pretty cordial?
Parts of it were very cordial. The two men spoke very much about the need to have Russia as part of Europe, and that Russia is deeply European, and Emmanuel Macron talked about Europe going from Lisbon to Vladivostok. Now, of course, this would have been music to Vladimir Putin's ears, but the background to that is that Europe and the United States is very concerned that Russia is moving closer to China. So that would have worked well for Vladimir Putin. On the other side, though, there were a few issues that really did turn the tone of the conversation somewhat, and in particular, when it came to human rights. The French president was under enormous pressure to mention the protests in Moscow, these protests that have come about because some candidates have been barred from running in the council elections there. And Emmanuel Macron said he wanted to believe that this would be the summer of freedom of protest, freedom of speech in Russia. And he felt that there really should be more done for freedom of speech and freedom to demonstrate in Moscow. Vladimir Putin, of course, turned around straight away and defended what was being done in the Russian capital and said that what they didn't want to see was a situation such as was in France earlier this year and late last year, when there were these big yellow vest demonstrations and Vladimir Putin said, by his calculation, 11 people were killed and 2,500 were injured. Well, Vladimir Putin may well say that, but Emmanuel Macron bounced back very quickly and said there was no equivalent. With what happened with the yellow vest movement in Paris was that it got out of hand and there was violence. It wasn't that they were banned from demonstrating. So that was the one time when it did actually get a bit frosty.
Did the issue about Russian nuclear arms come up?
No, it didn't come up, but they did say that they were going into a working dinner and that many of the issues that were going to be coming up later on this week at the G7 would be discussed. What they did discuss in great detail is Ukraine. Now, Emmanuel Macron is trying to kickstart these stalled negotiations, which include Russia and the Ukraine, but also as interlocutors or facilitators for that, France and Germany. So they are saying that they want this to happen, and they, in particular, Emmanuel Macron, hoping in the next few weeks there will be a summit of those four countries. Whether or not that happens, that's difficult to see because it really has that far. They are also, though, still hoping that if anyone can bring influence in Iran with all the nuclear deals, that it will be Vladimir Putin. So he will be talking about that. But the other issue that came out in all of this was that Emmanuel Macron is very concerned that he's being treated a bit as though he's just the intermediary, that in fact Emmanuel Macron will now finish his meeting with Vladimir Putin, the Russian president, write it all down and report back to the American president, Donald Trump, when he meets him at the G7, also in the south of France, at the end of this week.
That's the perception from Russia, is that what you're saying?
That's the perception, yes, that without a doubt, all the discussions that went on tonight will, of course, be fed into discussions that are going to be had later in the week, especially Syria, Iran, Ukraine. On this particular stage, Vladimir Putin got the stage he wanted. He's welcomed back into the Western world. He was actually asked, does he want to rejoin the G7? No, of course, Russia was thrown out in 2014 after they seized Crimea. And Vladimir Putin said, well, no, but there clearly is a need for Russia to be welcomed back into the international community. Russia is still under harsh economic sanctions because of what's been going on in Crimea and Eastern Ukraine. Russia really does need to get their economy moving again. And, of course, it does need to be accepted back into the Western world again.
All right. Thank you for being with us. That's Paris-based reporter Catherine Field. The Trump administration is continuing talks with the Taliban on a peace deal in Afghanistan despite another wave of terrorist violence these past few days. A deadly bomb blast killed more than 60 people at a wedding Saturday, and more bombings injured scores on Monday in eastern Afghanistan, just as the country celebrated its 100th anniversary. VOA's Arash Arbasadi has more.
Monday in Jalalabad, on the 100th anniversary of Afghanistan's independence, 10 bombs blasted restaurants and public squares, wounding at least 66 people. Those explosions came less than 48 hours after a suicide bomber detonated at a wedding in Kabul. That blast, claimed by Islamic State, killed 63 and injured hundreds. At a ceremony in Kabul marking Independence Day, Afghan President Ashraf Ghani vowed revenge on those responsible for the attacks.
They targeted civilians and attacked our children and women. In a brutal way, they shed the blood of our countrymen. We will avenge this mass killing of our innocents.
Recently in Qatar, representatives from the Taliban met in an unofficial capacity with Afghan delegates to discuss an end to the violence that has gripped Afghanistan for the past 18 years. The Taliban refuses to hold direct talks with the Kabul government, but has been meeting with the U.S. Trump administration envoy Zalmay Khalilzad has been leading the U.S.-Taliban talks. And Sunday in New Jersey, President Donald Trump expressed both optimism and doubt about the outcome of the dialogue.
We're talking to Afghanistan, both the government and also talking to the Taliban, having very good discussions. We'll see what happens. Well, I'm not trusting anybody. Look, I'm not trusting anybody. It's a horrible situation that's going on in Afghanistan. It has been for many years.
Taliban and U.S. negotiators in recent days have repeatedly asserted they are ready to sign a peace deal. But both sides say they still have some details to discuss. Arash Arbasadi, VOA News, Washington.
Well, China's been trying to sway public opinion on the protests in Hong Kong. The New York Times reports Facebook and Twitter found evidence of just how active China has been in trying to sow discord. Both social media giants said Monday that they had discovered and taken down networks of accounts that had originated in mainland China, where both Facebook and Twitter are blocked. The Times report says the accounts had posted that the Hong Kong protesters were acting violently and accused them of ulterior motives. One Facebook post likened the protesters to ISIS fighters. VOA's Ira Melman spoke with Priscilla Moriucci, a former cyber expert with the U.S. National Security Agency, who is now in charge of nation-state research at the cyber company Recorded Future.
We've looked at how Chinese state-run media essentially seeds the social media environment, right, with distorted or biased content, right, that's propagated by state-run media outlets, social media accounts, right, in the English language sphere, right? So kind of all the large social media providers. You know, over time, right, we've sort of demonstrated how these accounts, right, are trying to portray, you know, not just China's version of how the world is and what China should look like, but change people's minds by presenting a view of news, right, that's either false or distorted significantly.
Who in the Chinese government or what agencies or organizations in China are carrying out these operations?
So broadly, you know, all of the messages that get distributed both domestically and to the foreign speaking public are run by, you know, the propaganda ministry. We examine sort of six Chinese publications that have social media presence in English-speaking social media platforms and who have, if not their entire mission, part of their mission to sort of educate the international public about China. And so this includes, like, publications people might be familiar with, like Xinhua News, right? It's China's national news service. Other ones, The People's Daily, for example, which is another newspaper, The Global Times, China Global Television Network, and a few others. So we looked specifically at these state-run media organizations, their social media accounts online, and how they attempt, right, to influence the foreign public.
Do they attempt to hack into some of the sites that are being used by the protesters in Hong Kong?
Not these entities in particular. It's possible that other Chinese organizations, military units or whatever, are trying to utilize cyber operations to disrupt protests, but we haven't seen that, or that's not what we're looking at.
Is it working?
The state-run media are walking this line between positive support for the Hong Kong government, right, for Carrie Lam, the police, law enforcement, efforts to uphold law and order in the Hong Kong economy, with any negative characterizations of Hong Kong protest violence, right? So often, so what we've seen over the past few months, for example, is there'll be a characterization of the violence in Hong Kong with a specific negative term, right? Terrorist act, for example, or near terrorism, for example, that will be balanced and outweighed by these counter posts, right, which are overwhelmingly positive and demonstrate sort of the central government's support for Hong Kong as a global financial hub, Hong Kong's financial recovery after the damage from the protests, support for law and order in Hong Kong. So it's an interesting line that they're attempting to walk, right, where they're trying to portray central government as constructive, right, supportive, but at the same time condemn the protests.
To what end?
Every country has their own strategic goals, right, and the way that they would like to see the world and they would like foreign publics to view them. China really wants to be seen as a constructive contributor to global prosperity, right? They want to be seen as what, you know, Bush administration officials would have called a responsible stakeholder, right, back then. And especially in contrast to, you know, the what they see as kind of the current unpredictability and chaos, right, that's existent in the U.S. political system right now. And so their, you know, social media information manipulation campaigns, right, are very centered around portraying China in a positive light to the extent that they distort information, not just by not mentioning that information, right, but by falsely reporting information that might be detrimental to China and people, the global population's view of China itself. So, you know, from a Chinese perspective, they benefit, right, from the world seeing them in a positive light. And that really are their goals.
That's VOA Asia's Ira Melman speaking via Skype to Priscilla Moriucci, head of nation state research at the cyber company Recorded Future. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
Hello, thank you for listening to Border Crossings with Larry London. This month, Border Crossings is giving away a really cool Voice of America t-shirt.
Hooray!
If you want to win one of these awesome shirts, all you have to do is make a song request for our show.
I see it, I like it, I want it, I got it, yeah.
Tune into Border Crossings at 1500 Universal Time every weekday in August for your chance to win.
VOA's International Edition continues. India's tiger population has increased by more than 30% in the last 4 years, according to the latest tiger census that was recently released. The country counted 2,967 tigers last year, up from 2,226 4 years ago. India has one of the world's largest conservation programs to protect the big cat, but shrinking habitats and poaching have posed a problem. Joining us now to talk more about what India has done to protect this iconic species is Dr. John Goodrich, Chief Scientist and Tiger Program Director with the group Panthera. Nice to hear some good news about wildlife for a change.
The news from India is fantastic. They've estimated about 3,000 tigers in India, and India is truly the leader in tiger conservation of all the tiger range states. And one of the reasons things are going so well there is they have a very long history of conservation. They started Project Tiger in the 1970s. They now have over 50 protected areas called tiger reserves that are protected specifically for tigers. Those reserves are patrolled. They have a very active and very successful tourism program, and they're actively dealing with human-tiger conflicts, when tigers wander out of these protected areas and attack livestock or sometimes even people. So with all these things combined, they're doing a really fantastic job.
Do you think this could be a trend for the rest of the world, or are we still seeing the opposite in other places, the few places that there are tigers?
Well, I hope it could be a trend for the rest of the world. It certainly is a trend for South Asia. So in India, Nepal, and Bhutan, tigers are doing really well. In stark contrast, in Southeast Asia, in Thailand, Malaysia, and Indonesia, tigers are really struggling, and Malaysia is probably in the most desperate shape right now, and Thailand and Indonesia doing a little bit better. But in those countries, poaching is so bad, and it's putting tremendous pressure on the tiger populations. And we've lost tigers from Laos, from Vietnam, and from Cambodia since the turn of the century.
Meaning gone?
Gone, extirpated, poached out.
How dire is it in the other countries that you named that were struggling?
Recently, WWF has stated that they expect if we don't do something, tigers may be extirpated from Malaysia within the next 3 years. I'd be a little bit more optimistic than that, but still it's a dire situation. In general, there are, by some estimates, about 1 million square kilometers of vacant tiger habitat out there. Much of it is in Southeast Asia, and it's vacant because tigers have been poached out.
Why are they poaching them? For what?
Primarily for the traditional Asian medicine market, with primary countries that are buying the products being China and Vietnam.
Are they taking any approaches to try to reverse that, like the efforts that have been done, say, for the use of ivory?
Absolutely. There are efforts at every end of the spectrum. You know, training and try to increase protection on the ground in protected areas through ranger patrols, all the way up to efforts to stop wildlife trade at the international level, and even efforts to influence demand in user countries. Traditional Chinese medicine, so tiger parts are being consumed for medicinal purposes.
What are the numbers like as far as how many tigers there are, the estimates of the numbers that have been lost?
Well, we don't have good numbers for number of tigers poached per year because poaching is such an illicit activity and most of it goes under the radar. But right now we estimate there are about 4,000 tigers left in the wild. That number will probably increase a little bit with India's recent estimate, but for all intents and purposes, let's say 4,000. 100 years ago, we estimate there was 100,000 tigers out there. So that's the kind of decline we're looking at.
Has it amplified in recent years, or has it just been a steady decline?
No, it's definitely amplified in recent years with improving economic conditions in Asia. It creates more of a demand. There are more people that are able to afford tiger parts.
Why is it important that we do everything we can to protect this species?
You know, I get asked that question a lot, and I have a two-part answer. And the first part is that tigers are the biggest cat in the world. They're one of the most magnificent animals on our planet. Everybody loves tigers. Everybody knows what a tiger is. Even people that live near tigers revere them. They are cultural and religious icons throughout Asia. They're the symbols of a number of governments in Asia. You know, with such an important animal, if we can't protect them, what can we protect? And we have to ask questions about our own viability on this planet. From a more practical standpoint, it's important to conserve tigers because they're a species at the top of the food chain. We can think of them as an umbrella species because they require a lot of area. So if we're protecting tigers, we're probably protecting most of the other species in that ecosystem. And we can think of them as a keystone species at the top of the food chain, where if we remove them, there will be sort of a cascade effect through the wildlife community in that ecosystem. Losing a species, especially one as iconic as tigers, is tragic.
Are you hopeful?
I am hopeful. You know, the news coming out of India, the recent news, we're seeing that kind of news from some other countries, especially Nepal, Bhutan. Tigers are doing okay in Russia. And the thing that perhaps makes me the most hopeful is that million square kilometers of vacant habitat out there. There's a lot of space left for tigers. All we need to do is stop the poaching. You know, conceptually, it's a simple recipe for tigers. We need to leave them alone. We need to stop killing them, and they will flourish.
That's Dr. John Goodrich, Chief Scientist and Tiger Program Director with the group Panthera. Thank you so much for being with us.
My Invisalign has...
I have taken out my Invisalign,
and this is the album.
Underground music sensation Billie Eilish has finally had her number one hit on the Billboard Hot 100 after 9 weeks at number two on the charts. Her song Bad Guy has overtaken Lil Nas X's Old Town Road, featuring Billy Ray Cyrus, after a 19-week run in the number one spot. Eilish is the first artist born in the 2000s to make the Hot 100 list. Her song, Bad Guy, is from the album When We All Fall Asleep, Where Do We Go?, which debuted at number one on the Billboard 200 charts, album charts, I should say, in April.
So you're a tough guy, like you're really rough guy, just can't get enough guy, just always so puff.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for our show today, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
An editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In his address at the Ministerial to Advance Religious Freedom in July, Vice President Mike Pence described the Iranian regime as one of the world's worst violators of religious liberty.
It proves that religious freedom matters to literally billions of people all around the world. It's all of our concern. It is everyone's concern.
U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom Vice Chair Gail Manchin has chosen an Iranian prisoner of conscience for a project the commission instituted to bring attention to the plight of individuals persecuted solely for what they believe and to pressure the government to respect their religious liberty. That prisoner is Golrokh Ebrahimi Irai, an Iranian author and women's rights defender who is serving a 6-year prison sentence for so-called crimes of spreading propaganda and insulting Islamic sanctities, after authorities discovered an unpublished story she wrote critical of stoning.
She was put on trial twice. Neither time was she allowed to speak for herself, nor were her lawyers allowed to represent her. This is a woman that has been taken away from her family merely for bringing out the cruelty of stoning women for adultery.
Commission Vice Chair Nadine Meenza is also highlighting an Iranian prisoner of conscience, Youssef Nadarkhani, a pastor and Christian convert who spent years in prison and at one point was sentenced to death for apostasy, though he was later acquitted. But in July 2018, Pastor Nadarkhani was detained again to serve a 10-year prison sentence for acting against national security by promoting Zionist Christianity and running house churches, as Ms. Meenza recounted.
The Iranian police tried to knock his door down
In the middle of the night, his son opened the door. They lasered his son with an electric taser to the ground and then beat Pastor Natakani before arresting him and took him to prison. He's now serving a 10-year sentence in Evin prison in Tehran, which is one of the worst prisons in the world.
At the ministerial, Vice President Pence emphasized that the United States will continue to call out the persecution of religious minorities in Iran, and he had a message for the long-suffering Iranian people. Even as we stand strong against the leaders in Tehran, know that we are with you, and we urge you to press on with courage in the cause of freedom.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.